Okay, the second session will be a little bit shorter, probably. And we'll take more questions. And after this session, I'll take a question of whatever sort. Maybe it'll be a Bible question or whatever. I want to walk around, but this thing is tied down. Maybe, could you do me a favor? If you're sitting in the back, say, four rows, could you come forward? That way I can continue to use my voice. So please, if you don't mind, if you're sitting in the back four rows, thank you. Usually people don't even cooperate. I really appreciate that. Because that way I can still walk around. My voice is getting a little bit more ragged. I have my teacher's voice, but I'm not using it every day anymore since I retired. I'm doing a very terrible job of retiring. I retired for 6 months, and then I took a job where I'm working harder than ever before. A little crazy. All right, so we're going to do a question-answer session, like I said. And feel free to ask questions of a theological nature, you know, whatever. Don't ask me how to solve the national budget problem, but anything related to Christianity, okay? Thank you. By the way, you did a great job of having the first questions focused in on the topic, which I appreciate. All right, so anyway, generally when we do a question-answer session, questions come up about the age of the earth and what about evolution. They come up anyway, so I thought I'll just go ahead and do a talk about that. Now, a few years ago, we did a talk, we did a forum, you could call it a debate, a forum, Four Christian Views of Evolution. All right, and there were four positions there. One was by Kevin Anderson, and he took the scientific young earth position. I'll talk about that. But basically took the position that the earth is quite young and that science agrees with that. Okay, another person in the debate or forum was John Clayton, who's a very good friend of mine for many, many years. And he took the intelligent design position, which accepts the scientific ideas about the age of the earth, accepts that evolution has happened on some level, but is quite skeptical of macroevolution and does not necessarily agree with the idea of common descent. I took the position of what I call progressive creationism, which is the idea that evolution is consistent in general with the Bible. And I am not skeptical of the theory, although I believe the evolution theory cannot explain all the evidence we have with regard to the origin of life. And then another good friend of mine, notice the only guy I'm not calling a friend is this guy. He's a nice guy, but what can I say? I'd never met him. It was a struggle finding a PhD to defend that position. Dennis Lamoureux, he's a well-known speaker, and he took what evolutionary creationism, which I call deistic evolution. He took the position that God set the thing up, he set it in motion, and through fully random processes of evolution, it created all the different species. All right? So those are four Christian views of evolution. All right, so I'm going to do an outline here. I'm going to talk a little bit about what science and religion are about broadly, a little bit, tiny bit of philosophy there. Then I'm going to talk about the evidence for the age of the earth. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about Genesis chapter 1 and what that has to do with the evidence. Then I'll talk a little bit about evolution. And then I'll summarize by maybe saying a little bit more about those four Christian views. So what is science? Like they say, science, right? Didn't I say that? Oh. All right, it's the use of experiments to test theories about the laws of nature. So science involves things that can be measured. Science involves things that can be observed, and it involves creating explanations of observable things. And the idea is to create explanations that are not the truth, capital T truth, but to create explanations that are true in the sense that they're consistent with the evidence. By the way, by that definition, evolution is one of the best scientific theories ever created. By the way, I'm not Dennis Lamro. I don't think it does explain everything. However, I believe it is a good theory, and I'll tell you why I think it's a good theory. All right, scientific knowledge involves things that can be measured. Scientific knowledge changes and improves over time. It's neither true nor false. Good science is not true or false. Good science is consistent. Consistent with what? Consistent with experiment or evidence. By the way, I teach an intro to scientific thought class. I held it for many years at Grossmont College. And basically, I'm taking little slides out of that lecture. So I'm trying to explain what science is, what religion is, and why there are two very different ways of approaching asking and answering questions. Then I talk a little bit about a couple of questions that they both might kind of bump into each other occasionally for some reasons. All right, now here are some questions that I believe science is excellent at answering. Questions like, when did that happen? What is that thing? Where are those things? Where do you find that? How many of them are there? And why? There's two kinds of why. There's big W why, like why do we exist and all that kind of stuff. Science really stinks at that. But little W why, science is excellent at explaining why, you know, why is it bad for you to eat dirt or something? I don't know, whatever. Okay, got it? Science is great at answering those questions. But here's my question. Do you care about those questions? I don't. All right, here are the questions we care about. Like, why am I here? All right, is that the right thing to do? What is my value? Will God hear when I pray? Does the supernatural exist? Those are the questions we care about. And science, can I say this? Can you say this in mix on? Sucks. Science sucks. It's on the tape. Science, how about this? For more polite. See, for younger people, you can say that. For older people, it seems like the younger people are sitting over here and the older people are sitting over there. What's that about? What's that about? Right? All the young people are here. We're doing some self-sorting here.
Wow.
All right. So, for you guys, I'd say science is really bad at that. For you guys, science really sucks at that. Right? Oh, yeah. All right. Now, if science does establish why we're here, the answer is for no reason. There is no reason why you're here. There is no reason. It's just random accident. Is that the right thing to do? In science, the right doesn't even have a definition. You can't even define that. How valuable am I? I don't know, $7. You know, you got some calcium, some iron, some magnesium, right? Science is very bad at answering those questions, but science is pretty good at answering these questions. In fact, when we try to use our religious books to answer those questions, typically we get in trouble. Because religious books generally are not designed to answer questions like that. In the days of Galileo, the question was whether the earth moves or not. Does the Bible discuss whether or not the earth moves? No, it doesn't. But the Bible does say the sun sets. Now, does the sun set? No, the sun does not set. The sun is just sitting there moving, and we're rotating. So if you ever say the sun sets, you're making a science error. Either that or just talking. And in the Bible, generally, it's just talking, all right? And so generally, I would say when it comes to questions like this, all right, probably we should give science the first shot. But when it comes to questions like this, I think, like Galileo said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And that's a wise thing to say. For example, on things like how old is the earth? All right, so to explain what science is good at and what's bad at, here we go. Somebody says evolution is true. Have you ever heard somebody say that? Evolution is true. That is a bogus statement. Whoever says that either does not understand science or is trying to manipulate you, which is worse. I guess not understanding science is not as bad as manipulating you. Because what would it even mean to say that evolution is true? What would that even mean? All right? Now, what you could say is this. The theory of evolution is by far the best model we have to explain both the fossil evidence and the genetic evidence with regard to the origin of all species. That's true. If somebody has another theory, another scientific theory that involves observable phenomena in the lab and all kind of stuff, I haven't heard one, so I could say that. I addressed this earlier. Did the Big Bang happen? All right. Some people say the Big Bang happened. You know? How do you know that? I mean, were you around? I mean, you know. So what scientists can say, I'm just trying to explain the nature of science and scientific theories a little bit here. What you could say is the Big Bang model is in dramatic agreement with all known facts about the origin and history of the universe. So did it happen? I don't know. But you know what? I can say that. By the way, just, you know, I think it happened. All right? Yeah, just so you know. All right, but that's just what I think. So science seeks consistency, not truth. And I sometimes like to make the difference between a capital T truth and a little t truth. Like it's true that you're sitting there. All right, that's true. But is it true that we have infinite value, like the Bible says? All right, is it true? Is the law of gravity true? All right, science can't answer that question because our measurements are not precise enough to answer that kind of question. All right, so a couple of very, very quick conclusions. I'm going through a lot of stuff really quickly. Religion and science ask different kinds of questions and define words differently. They're two very different worldviews, although arguably science is not a worldview. Science is really more of a method, but for some people it is a worldview. That's who I'm talking about here. If Christianity is true, then the Bible should not contradict what we know from science. By the way, I believe it does not. Okay, great. Now, there are questions. See, for example, the age of the earth, the origin of species, you know, is there life elsewhere in the universe, these kinds of things. What about the dinosaurs? I think probably we should let science get the first stab at that. The questions about morality and purpose and value, things, we probably should let religion have the first go. But there are a couple of questions that, I'm sorry, science will never let go of, and religion will never let go of. So there will be continuous sort of, you know, some possible conflict. And these particular questions, for example, what is a human being? Science definitely wants to help answer the question of what is a human being. All right? And I think it's fair to say that religions, all religions, Christianity or any other, all try to answer that question. The origin of life, all religions have a story about the origin of life, and all religions have a cosmology, a story of the origin of the universe. And Hindus are not likely to let go of their story about the origin of the universe. Christians are not likely to let go of their story about the origin of life. So these are three questions that inevitably, you know, you can't just say, oh, don't worry about it, or let the other people have that question. All right, for example, on human consciousness, what is a person? Well, here's a question. Do you have a body, or are you a body? Well, what's science going to tend to say? That you have a body or you are a body? Science is going to say, you are a body, and that's all you are. All right, but I would say most humans totally disagree with that. You say, I have a body. This is my pinky. This is not me. This is my pinky. Anyway, that's probably a little bit too much philosophy, so let's move on from there. All right, I forgot that the slide was in there. This is Galileo. The Bible's written to show us how to go to heaven, not how heavens go. But another important statement of Galileo said, in discussions of physical problems, We ought to begin not from the authority of scriptural passages, but from the sense experiences and necessary demonstrations. By the way, you don't have to agree with Galileo. This is just his advice. I happen to think it's good advice, though. So, for example, the question in his day was whether or not the Earth moves. And he would observe, for example, that Venus goes through phases, just like the moon goes through phases. He would observe the moons of Jupiter going around Jupiter, and he was saying, this clearly implies that, you know, the planets are going around the sun, and I don't care what you think the Bible's saying, I'm pretty sure the Earth's going around the sun. So that's how he would apply that. I just untied my shoe by stepping. These are the worst shoes I ever owned for coming untied. There we go. Moving along. All right, I already had this one. Here's Francis Collins. You may be aware of him. He's the head of the NIH. He also headed the Human Genome Project. He's a very faithful believer in God. I met him, had a conversation with him. He wrote a book about evolution. I would suggest the book, The Language of God, by Francis Collins. Another book is Coming to Peace with Science by a friend of mine. That's pretty good. These are some reasons that Francis Collins says he believes in God. He says, because there's something as opposed to nothing. We were talking about the multiverse theory. The multiverse theory doesn't solve that problem at all. First of all, it's not even a scientific theory. And besides, it doesn't solve the problem. So like you said, that's their out. Okay, they can take that out if they want, but it doesn't solve the problem. The unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, the fact that math works is evidence for beauty, and beauty is from God. I talked about the Big Bang. That nature does not solve the question of why. I would use the capital W, why, fine-tuning of the universe, and the existence of morality. That's just one guy. All right, the age of the earth. This has been a long discussion. Famously, Bishop Usher, the Bishop of Ireland in 1640 said the earth was... Somebody's taking a picture, but that's not true, okay? But you can take a picture if you want. It's all right. It's okay. By the way, this presentation, I'm going to load it at my website, including the audio and all that. So you can take notes if you want. But anyway, he calculated 4004 BC, October 23rd. Okay, great. So, by the way, let's see. According to scientists, supposedly, how old is the Earth? 4.5, 4.6 billion years. That's what they would say. By the way, when I teach Science 110, after I'm about two-thirds of the way through the course, I say to my students, now, is that true? Is it true the Earth is that old? And they've figured out. They say, well, that's where the evidence points. Thank you very much for saying it that way. Okay, great. All right, what about the age of the universe? At least scientists claim. Well, you don't know that one. It's okay. Around 13.5 billion. Now, I'm not saying the universe is that old, and I'm not saying the Earth is that old. I'm just saying that's where science takes us. And I want to talk about some of the evidence for that. All right? There are two ways to measure the age of the universe, at least that are used. One of them is to figure out the distance to the most distant object in its current rate of motion and assume the Earth started, you know, small, and just divide those two numbers. And, you know, V equals D over T, so T equals D over V. All right, whatever that means. You just calculate it. And that produces the age of roughly 13.5 billion years. The other way to estimate the age of the universe is to observe what appears to be the oldest object in the universe. Now, they have theories about the evolution of stars and all that kind of stuff. And these involve, they're not exactly guesses, but it involves applying equations that work really well, so it's a reasonable thing. And they get, guess what? Around 13.5 billion years. So scientists seem to pretty much have, by the way, I made this slide probably 6 or 8 years ago. Those two numbers are now like plus or minus 0.1 billion. They've gotten closer. Because like I said, science changes over time and scientific knowledge improves over time. All right, so there you go. At this point, it's 13.4 plus or minus 0.1 or 0.2. So that's kind of where the evidence points. Does that mean the universe is that old? No, it just means that those two points of evidence point in that direction. What about the Earth? Is there evidence the Earth is only a few thousand years old? Let me tell you, no matter how many young Earth creationists shout and scream and jump up and down, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever, none, that the Earth is only a few thousand years old. By the way, I believe it could be only a few thousand years old. I'm going to explain that. I really believe that could be the case. But I'm just giving you the facts, which is there is no evidence, physical evidence, to support that conclusion. So this is a famous place where James Hutton looked, and he saw, you know, the layers, and then these other layers perpendicular, and these layers, you know, these disconformities in the Earth. And I challenge you to take a hike down the Grand Canyon and tell me that that was formed, 5,000, 6,000 years ago. I mean, this just doesn't make sense. Now, the way James Hutton said it, he said, there's no vestige of a beginning, no concept of an end, in his famous book, Theory of Earth. So he, obviously, who came up with this idea of the Earth being very old and uniformitarianism and all that kind of stuff, obviously somebody was going to ask him how old, and he said, I don't know, and I have no evidence to even conclude anything. So basically he said, just really, really old, because given what we can observe, it's obviously really, really old. Thank you for James Hutton for being honest and saying, I don't know. Okay, great. But, you know, that's the Grand Canyon, evidence of a bit of time there. All right. But then it turns out in the early 1900s, Ernest Rutherford developed the ability of using parent and daughter isotopes to estimate the age of a rock. And there are a number of methods. By the way, carbon-14 is irrelevant. People say you can't trust the scientists because carbon-14 is not accurate. First of all, carbon-14 is quite accurate. Second of all, what does it matter? Because it has a half-life of only 5,700 years. So nobody uses carbon-14 to talk about the age of the Earth. Whoever says that has proved immediately they don't know what they're talking about. All right, don't tell them that, but it's true. All right, great. So, it turns out you can take a rock. Again, there's assumptions being made about if it's been disturbed, and there's lots of things. It's a technical thing. But the bottom line is, if you know the proportion of the parent isotope and the daughter isotope, you can estimate the age of the rock. For example, if the rock is 99% of this and only 1% of that, then that rock is relatively young. Okay, got it? On the other hand, if it's, say, 50% this, and the number of atoms 50% that, given the half-life, that would mean it's 4.5 billion years old. So where do they find 4.5 billion year old rocks? Well, not on the Earth. Not yet. Because the Earth has undergone a lot of, you know, turnover. All right, so where do they find these rocks? On the moon. Now, there's whacked out people who think we never went to the moon, all right? People who say that, just don't listen to anything they say. Just walk away from those people. Maybe give them a hamburger first, you do the Jesus thing, be nice to them, but don't hold a conversation with those people. All right? All right, and the reason for this is the moon does not have geologic activity. And by the way, believe it or not, we've never gone to Mars and brought any rocks back, but believe it or not, there are meteorites that have hit the Earth that came from Mars. It's a technical explanation. And those, they vary in age because there's been some geologic activity. But meteorites and the moon all are almost exactly 4.5, 4.6 billion years. And there's a number, I'm not going to go into it. There are a number of lines of ability to calculate the age of the Earth based on different radioisotopes and other things. Some of them say like 2 billion plus or minus 3 billion, huge. But the bottom line is all of them point to the same conclusion, okay? Around 4.5 billion years old. All right? Now, what about Genesis chapter 1? Well, there are a number of different ideas. There are two young Earth theories. First one is the Earth is young and science supports this conclusion. This is not true. I don't care how often they say it, how loud they speak, and how many attempts they make to sort of muddy the waters and confuse you as to whether scientists know what they're talking about. It's just not true. I'm sorry, but there is no evidence the earth is young, and I'm saying none, period. So you don't have to believe me, but you know, this is kind of my job to find out about that. Now, another theory, which I believe is many Christians believe in, it's not my theory, but amen, you know, the earth is young because God created it that way. All right? Now, when Jesus made wine from water, how old was it? Like 1 second old. Right? But how old did it appear to be? I don't know, however long it takes wine to ferment. I don't know. When Jesus made fish, presumably they weren't little teensy tiny fish, they were like fish. How old did those fish appear to be? I don't know, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't know, 6 months, 3 years, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All right? So was Jesus deceiving the people when he did that? No. So here's how I handle it. When I teach, because I have a lot of, like, fairly conservative Christians at Grossmont College that kind of go real hard for the younger thing. So here's how I teach. I say, all right, so let's talk about the age of the universe. You know, I'm sure some of you were taught to believe the earth is only a few thousand years old. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to defend that position. So I literally walk across the stage. Right? I'm not going to speak it as a scientist. I'm going to go over there. I'm going to speak as a theologian. They don't realize that I actually know a little theology. So I'm going to be here. Okay, so let's talk about theology. Let's propose that there exists an all-knowing, omniscient, omnipotent, all those omni-thing God, right? Could that God create the universe with an appearance of age? I mean, how could you deny it? Yeah, of course that God could. All right. So what if that was true? What if we tested the earth? What would we observe? Age. So this is a possible explanation of science, if you will, that could be consistent with the book of Genesis. In other words, literally, day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, a few thousand years ago. And who am I to say that God did or didn't or would or wouldn't do that? You know what I'm saying? Now, I don't agree with that, but to me, that's a rational position. I would defend a person who defended it, even though I don't agree with them. Now, there's some reasons why I don't agree with that, and maybe it's partly because I'm a scientist and I'm just sort of biased. That is a definite possibility. Let me give you a couple of facts, though, that are not like, really? I don't know. Maybe, I guess. For example, let's say you're looking through a telescope at a galaxy which is 1 billion light years away. The light, the photons that are hitting the mirrors and then hitting your eye, presumably, when did they leave that galaxy? I'll give you a hint. All right. The galaxy is 1 billion light years away. So how long ago did the light leave that galaxy? 1 billion years ago, all right? So now, if theory number two is true, then my question is, does that galaxy even exist? All right? Now, wait a minute. God could create the universe with galaxies full-blown and put the light in process. I mean, if he wanted to, God can do whatever he wants. But, I don't know, who am I to judge such things? But I find that to be surprising. How about that? I just flat out don't believe it. And by the way, if the universe and the earth are only a few thousand years old, then dinosaurs definitely did not exist. I mean, whether they existed or not, if they did, it was more than like 60 million years ago. Right? That's for sure. I don't care what the creationists say. They're wrong. The whole human footprints next to the dinosaur footprints, don't believe that. It's not true. All right. So that's the first possibility. And again, I believe this theory is not irrational, stupid, or anything like that. This theory is wrong. You can believe a wrong theory if you want, but you'll be wrong. And if, as a parent, if you teach that to your kids, that's going to be very, very problematic. So do your kids a favor, and if you believe that, keep it to yourself. I'm serious. All right? Now, then there's the Dage theory, the literary theory, it's all just a myth. It's not all just a myth. You know why it's not all just a myth? Because the universe is created, you know? But the Dage theory, so that's the idea that essentially Genesis 1, basically Genesis, although it's not a scientific treatise, that it's principally about God's theology and the fact that God created order out of disorder and all these kinds of things. Nevertheless, day one is kind of what God did first, then day two is what he did next, and day three is what he did next. So that would be the Dage theory. But the days are just, you know, not literal. It's just, I mean, in fact, even Jewish philosophers, even Philo, the Jewish theologian in the first century, believed these days were not literal, that they were, you know, represented progressive periods over which God did his work. And then there's the literary theory, which is that there's no actual historical content, that it's literary. For example, the first day and the third day are about light. The second day and the fourth day are about the heavenly bodies. And the third day and the sixth day are about the creatures and all those kind of things. All right, so those are some possibilities. Now, a quick summary of Genesis 1. First of all, according to Genesis 1, God preexisted the universe. Number one. Number two, God created the universe. Number three, then he created the earth. Then he created life on the earth. And then he created us. Okay? You could read a number of creation myths, the Babylonian creation myth. There's many of them. And all other creation myths other than the Bible have these weird, bizarre, strange things. Tiamat killed, you know, blah, 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 and all these sorts of things. The Bible's creation myth, if you will, is a straightforward account which contains facts which, as far as I understand it, if we take the Dage theory, do not contradict with known science. A little bit more detail. These are early believers, Philo a Jew, Origen, Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas being Christians, all of whom said, based with no scientific reason to say it, saying they believe that these days should be taken in a metaphorical way, and they represent the periods of time or progressive things over which God created the universe. Don't take them literally. All right, great. So that's my very quick version of talking about the age of the earth for what it's worth, and I guess talking about Genesis 1 for what it's worth, and I'll take all the questions you want to throw at me. All right, so next I want to talk about evolution. So what does the Bible say about the origin of species? According to the Bible, how did all the species get there? God made them. All right? Does it say how God did that? Well, he said he spoke the universe into existence, I guess. It doesn't really say. So how much is evolution discussed in the Bible? The answer is it's not discussed at all. I haven't seen any discussion about the theory of evolution. All right, so but according to the Bible anyway, God created every form of life. But it doesn't tell how, and probably if he'd explained it, probably the readers would have not understood it. And besides, his goal was not to explain, you know, the processes through which species evolved or created. His theory, his point was to explain himself and to disprove Babylonian false ideas about God. All right? So, if the Bible doesn't explain the origin of species, then I think we have a good reason to ask, well, what does nature say? Okay, got it? So what does the physical evidence say? For example, what does the fossil evidence say about the origin of species, if anything? What does the genetic and DNA evidence say about the origin of species, if anything? And is there such a thing as irreducible complexity, as the intelligent design people seem to believe? And what about the evolution of humans? That's a touchy topic, is it not? Okay, great. By the way, I'm going to tell you, I believe in Adam and Eve. I believe there was an original man and an original woman. You know why I believe in Adam and Eve? Because it's in the Bible. And why do I believe it? Because it's in the Bible. Because the Bible's, every time I can test it, the Bible's always right and accurate. So I'll use an analogy. I believe my wife is faithful to me. So what if I saw a piece of evidence that said differently, like she had lunch with some guy? Am I going to begin to doubt whether she's faithful to me? No, that's ridiculous. That would be irrational. I guarantee you, if that happened, there's a perfectly good explanation, which is either it didn't actually happen or whatever. I just have to ask her. She has totally, totally earned the benefit of the doubt. And when it comes to the inspiration of the Bible has earned for me anyway the benefit of the doubt. So if the Bible says Adam and Eve, you know, first man, first woman, I just believe it. And here's the thing is, I think we as Christians, we need to separate the things we believe because of the evidence from the things we believe because the Bible says so. All right? For example, I believe the Bible's inspired because of the evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. I believe the universe was created because of the evidence. I believe life was created because of the evidence. I believe Jesus is the Messiah, the one that was to come, because of the evidence. I believe in heaven just because the Bible says so. And I have no evidence. I have absolutely no evidence. I believe God's in control. 10% because of the evidence and 90% because the Bible says so. All right. I believe in Adam and Eve because the Bible says so and it's always right, so I just believe it. All right. But I'm still going to talk about evolution. I'm not going to cover up the evidence and pretend. All right. Got it? So what about human evolution? All right. That's Charles Darwin on the head, by the way, in case you didn't know. All right, that's disrespectful. All right. So let's talk about Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin came up with one of the most amazing theories ever. And by the way, the evidence he used to support his theory, he didn't use fossil evidence at all. Not, if you read his book, Origin of Species, he does not mention any fossil evidence. He also does not mention any DNA evidence, obviously, because DNA wasn't discovered for more than 100 years after. All right? The evidence he used was from living species. For example, famously, the 14 different species of finch on the Galapagos Islands, which he proposed had evolved from a single species in South America, using some pretty good arguments. All right, got it? And yet, over time, there is some support for the idea of evolution from the fossil record. However, the fossil record is patchy at best, with massive unfilled links in it. And let me just say this. As a rule, the fossil evidence generally is supportive as opposed to unsupportive of evolution. But to now, end of story, based on the fossil evidence, is that's way outside of what the evidence has. But here's the deal. In a good theory, over time, the evidence is more aligning with as opposed to going against your theory. And over time, as we get more fossil evidence, it tends to more support rather than throw out the theory of evolution. But I would say, on balance, the fossil evidence is it's strong on some kind of evolution happening for sure, but common descent of all species from an early bacteria, that's way far from being demonstrated from the fossil evidence. This is the supposed origin of whales, which I think probably the evidence is fairly good, that earlier versions of whales were crawling around on the ground. Okay? Just so the evidence points toward, okay? Don't get mad at me for saying that. I'm just, you know, all right? And then there's the whole horse thing and the idea that all mammals at least appear based on the bone structure. probably to all go back to some sort of earlier mammalic form that would be in common. Even dolphins, which have no particular purpose for having those remnant finger-like bones. All right, so the idea that all mammals are somehow related, it's not a stupid idea. All right? It's not a crazy idea. It's not from Satan. Okay, got it? Now, this slide might make you angry. But it's just the information, folks. If you get angry, you have to ask yourself what you're getting angry at. Okay, so over here we have human chromosome number 2. Here we have chimp chromosome 2P and 2Q. And you can see the homologous nature here. Because we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and chimps have 24 pairs of chromosomes. Okay? But look. It appears either that two chromosomes joined or one chromosome broke at some point in the. It appears that way. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying, you can see the evidence for yourself. And when an evolutionist hears that, that evolution's not real and they have that, they're going to tend to discount you, probably. So here we go. This means human, chimp, gorilla, and orangutan. Human, chimp, gorilla, and orangutan. That says to me that the chimp, the gorilla, and the orangutan are, on one branch. And it kind of looks like the human's on the other branch. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying what's the evidence. Okay, great. Here's another one. Pseudogenes. We have genetic information in us that is useless. But that's evidence that at one time it was useful. Let me tell you every single mammal that cannot make vitamin C. All right, that is, I might miss one. It is gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, orangutans, humans, and guinea pigs. Right? Every single mammal that does not make vitamin C. Humans, gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, bonobos, I might have missed one, and guinea pigs. But we have the gene to make vitamin C, but it's broken. All right, now, common sense says that's not a coincidence. All right? Just common sense says that's not a coincidence. And by the way, the gene for making vitamin C in guinea pigs is broken, but it's broken in a different place. Okay? So I'm just giving you that information. The implication is sort of strong here, don't you think? All right. And then there's all the viral insertions. Read either Collins's book or what's his name? Our friend from... Daryl Falk. Daryl Falk is even better, in my opinion. Daryl Falk is even better than Collins' book. Retroprosons. So, for example, we have viral DNA in our DNA. All right? And you can look at different species that have the same chunk of viral DNA in them and kind of go, well, that's interesting because common sense says they're closer to each other, and they also have the same viral insertion. I'm probably overwhelming you with information, okay? Let me give you my conclusion. The bottom line is, although the fossil evidence is weak at proving common descent of all species, in fact, it's quite weak, the genetic evidence is very strong, okay? It just is. If you don't like it, it still is. Okay? For example, if you look at the parts of the DNA that code to actually do something, if you look at the amount that are in common with humans, it kind of makes sense, right? Which do you think probably would have DNA more similar to humans? Gorillas or roundworms? Now, this does not prove anything. This data proves absolutely nothing. Because if God was going to make a creature similar to another creature, he'd probably use a similar design, right? Doesn't prove anything. All right? Now, so therefore, I conclude that the evidence from genetics very strongly supports the idea of common descent, and the evidence from fossils is weak at best. Although it doesn't contradict it, it's weak at best. All right, here we go. But then there's evidence in the science that undermines the idea of, remember my friend from University of Edmonton, you know, the evolution guy, the evolutionary creationism guy, you know, from the debate. Yeah. Dennis Lamoureux. Dennis Lamoureux would go for the whole God is so intelligent and so smart, he just set the machine up and let it go, and look what happened. I don't agree with that. And here's why I don't agree with it. Because there is a lot of reason to believe that it's not random. For example, there's the Cambrian explosion. It turns out if you look at the fossil record, if you look at 560 million years ago, there are no animals. Then you look 530 million years ago, not only are there, you know, millions of kinds of animals, but every phyla that ever existed has already existed. To me, this is clear evidence that God just did something. Also, the amount of genetic change that's required. Mathematicians basically generally completely reject evolution right off the bat. You're kidding. You actually believe that? Because the amount of genetic change, for example, let's go back to this slide. All right, so 98% the same as chimpanzees. But what's 98%? What's 2% of 4 billion? I think that's 80 million. That's 80 million mutations. And the populations have never been very large. And if you look at statistical arguments, the idea that evolution just sort of whatever, just sort of went along its own pace completely randomly, I just think that's really difficult to support. In fact, I would say there's quite strong evidence that God was involved all along. Now, I'm going to use an analogy, and this is just an analogy. And you can't teach truth using analogies, okay? But I'm going to give you an analogy. All right, does God intervene to sort of change the path of history very often?
Yes.
Like when?
The flood,
okay.
The cross.
Egypt. And maybe one other place, and that's it. God intervened with Hitler? I don't know what you're talking about there. So, generally, God allows free will to kind of go its own way. And God very, 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 very rarely intervenes to change the course of what history would have done. What about your life? Does God change the light from green to red to green so you can make it to your work on time? No! You know, the non-Christian has exactly the same shot as you. I'm pretty sure. God allows free will to work. God does not intervene in our lives individually except very, very rarely and only for a good reason. And feel free to pray about that. I pray about it. I believe it. I've seen it. But honestly, doesn't drop, you know, pork out of the sky so you could have some for your dinner. That, you know, it just doesn't work that way. And I believe that the physical world works the same, that God created laws that work the way they work. Why did he create the laws if he was going to break them all the time? I believe God very, very rarely breaks his own laws, and he only does it for a reason. And I believe that is how nature appears to me. There's no way that we would have evolved from bacteria. And besides, I believe Adam and Eve were special created. I just flat out believe it. Right? I believe God said, Adam, and then Eve. All right, and that we all of us are the descendants of Adam, and Eve, which are the only ones ever created in the image of God. All right, so the bottom line is, do I have some sort of a summary here? Here's the picture of the all of time in this very, very narrow region of time in which all animals that ever, all animals are created seemingly without animals before. Cameron explosion. There are a number of other examples like this. So, here are some tentative conclusions. Okay, number one, evolution has happened. Okay, it's true, it has happened. Evolution has been shown. For example, the AIDS virus evolves even inside of human beings. Evolution has been demonstrated in the laboratory, including mutations that allow a species to survive better than if it hadn't been mutated. So evolution definitely has happened. Evolution on a small scale is a fact. Fossil evidence strongly supports the idea of change over time, but that change often happens in surprisingly sudden bursts. Either that, or maybe God just did whatever he does whenever he chooses to do it, and we don't know, and it's not scientific to say that. I'll just say I believe God intervenes. Okay, genetic evidence gives rather strong support to the idea of common descent. For example, that all mammals are connected. And all fish, for example, would be connected. That's what the evidence says. Like it or not, this is even true of human beings. In other words, it is not a stupid and ridiculous idea to say that we have a common ancestor with chimpanzees. Now, I believe we're specially created, right? I do. I mean, the fact that we have a consciousness, the fact that we have the same emotions that God has, the fact that we have the ability to create, the fact that we're self-aware, all these things are clear evidence that we're made in the image of God. And no evolution would produce that. Are you kidding? A spirit, a soul, an everlasting, thing? All right? But the idea that humans have a common ancestor with the other great apes is not stupid. And it's not because Satan rules science. The fact is, the evidence supports the idea. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying any more than that. I'm saying the evidence supports at least that as an idea. Statistical and other arguments like the Cambrian explosion give support to the idea that God has intervened at many times. All right, exactly when and exactly how often, we just don't know. But I believe there's clear evidence that evolution is not all that there is to explain the origin of life. And besides, God invented evolution, so why not give him credit for it? I mean, evolution is a means by which species change over time in response to changes on the earth over time. And the earth changes over time, and therefore, thank God for evolution, which is a means by which God allows creatures to change over time. So if God invented the idea, then why would you want to get defensive about it? All right, okay, so there's that debate we had. Okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go into these different ideas. We'll just say those are ideas you can look at my website. So anyway, so the first two presentations were like, yeah! This is awesome. The Bible is right, and those people are all wrong. It's awesome. The third part about evolution, a few of you are kind of giving me that look like, oh, I don't know about this. It's making me uncomfortable. Well, I'm sorry, but if the scientific evidence makes you uncomfortable, I'm a scientist. It's kind of my job to show it to you and provide some possible explanations, and then you have to do with it what you will. Okay, great. So we have about half an hour to take as many questions. And at this point, the questions can come from any aspect of Christianity. Does not have to stick to the topic. Yes?
Just a clarification question. On the last slide that we were talking through,
yeah,
there was a part that said that it supports something theistic but not deistic.
Right. All right. That's because I used a word that I never defined. So thank you for pointing that out. Okay. Let me find that one. So deism is a philosophy. Famous deists would include Isaac Newton, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, some of these founding fathers who were Christians very dubiously. The deist believes that the universe was created and that God is the creator of that universe, but that God created the universe and essentially let it go on its own. The idea of deism was created during mainly what's known as the Enlightenment. They wanted Christianity to be rational, and so this rationalistic sort of analysis of Christianity, rather than reading the Bible and letting it speak for itself, produced the idea of deism. And one of the guys in that debate, essentially, his view of evolution is deistic. In other words, thank you. In other words, God is not intervening in that process. It's fully a mechanical process. I believe that that's not true. I'm sorry, I don't agree with that. On Judgment Day, if it turns out I'm wrong, Dennis Lamoureux, shake his hand, give him a hug. Awesome guy, I like him a lot. I really like him a lot. By the way, when we had that debate, he actually won the debate. I did not, he did. The reason is his position is so much easier to defend, and mine is hard to explain. All right, so he actually, in my opinion, he actually won the debate. Alright, so, but I believe because of things like the Cambrian explosion, because of the statistical arguments which seem to make the idea of fully random changes be literally not even possible, and also for theological reasons, which is that God generally set things up and lets them go as they will. That's nature has free will just like we do, and he intervenes, but only very, very rarely, and only for a definite purpose. For all those reasons, I believe evolution does not explain fully the origin of species, that God is the ultimate explanation, not just deistically, but theistically. So theism is basically a system where God is involved. For example, a theist says, if I pray, God will do something. The deist says, if I pray, okay, well, I'm talking to the top of my head. All right, next question.
Dr. Oaks, I wanted to ask about, because I saw on the slides, it said, because I've seen microevolution before,
right.
But then there's also macro
right.
evolution. So my understanding was micro was a small changes over time, like say with the environment changing and having
yeah.
that thing where the macros were, they totally evolved from a different species to another species. So
right.
Is that true?
Right. So, by the way, I took an evolution class a few years ago. I thought if I'm going to talk about it, I should probably study it. All right, and I thought that biologists would reject this distinction between micro and macroevolution because what's the cutoff? You know, how much change? So I think we all agree that all dogs are related to, you know, they're all related. Do we agree that lions, tigers, you know, mountain lions and leopards, they're all related? Is that microevolution or is it not? But then when I took my evolution class, lo and behold, they teach that, they talk about it. And the reason they talk about it is because microevolution is observable, and they can quantify it, they can measure it, and et cetera. So, for example, as populations change over time. For example, it explains why African Americans get sickle cell anemia at a higher rate, because if they have one copy of that recessive gene, it gives them defense against malaria. So in high malaria areas, people survive. Right, so things like that. But macroevolution, which in my opinion is hard to define, really hard to define, that would be, for example, to say that, for example, they say birds evolved from dinosaurs. Whether that's true or not, I honestly don't know. I don't think it's a stupid idea. I don't think it's a crazy idea. But if all birds evolved from a dinosaur-like thing, then that would be macroevolution. And I believe macroevolution is not demonstrated by the fossil evidence. It's just not. However, it's consistent with the genetic evidence for what it's worth. Nevertheless, I believe that evolution is a process that God has directed and intervened in, otherwise it would not have happened. Okay, next question. Feel free to go as far away from our field if you want, or stay here if you want as well. Up to you. We've got about 20 more minutes. Okay, great. All right, so the water above the heaven thing. Now, the water, there's water up there, okay? Now, there is this theory, it's called the canopy theory, to explain the flood. All right, but the canopy theory is just a bunch of nonsense. It's just nonsense. All right, so the idea is that at some point, you know, people are sinning, and God, he's ready to judge, so he's had all this water up here. He said, okay, let it fall. And then it does, and the flood happens. But if there was that much water in the sky, then no sunlight would get through to the earth. I mean, the bottom line is, I believe the flood happened, and I believe the flood was a miracle. All right? But why create some crazy idea about a canopy theory to explain what the Bible clearly is presenting as a miracle anyway? So the fountains of the deep opened up. This is Calvinist stuff. You got to be aware, people with a Calvinist perspective have certain presuppositions they're bringing to the table. All right, so they think that lions didn't eat, you know, gazelles before the fall. You know, stuff like that. That's Calvinism. All right, but we're not Calvinists. All right, we believe in free will, and we, you know, so I think I lost your question. Can you reel me back in, please?
Well, I guess also as it relates to people who use like scriptures that talk about that to argue for a firmament as it relates to the flat earth theory.
Right, right. Well, anyway, the question is, does the Old Testament essentially, does God accommodate false ideas in the Old Testament? And, you know, there's a big discussion there. People will disagree on that. I believe it does not. I believe the Bible does not describe the earth as flat. I believe the Bible does not just talk about the crystal sphere and all the things that are in, say, the Quran and other religious writings of the ancient world. Now, when God had the Old Testament written, he used the language, the vocabulary that was used to describe that false cosmology, because those are the only words they had in their language. All right, so when he talks about the firmament, I don't think he's describing some sort of false cosmology that's not true. Generally, it's being used in poetic passages anyway. All right, and so that's a fairly complicated question, honestly, and to answer it is it takes a little bit of nuance. All right, but although the Old Testament uses words that were in the vocabulary of people who believed in these levels of heaven and all this sort of the sublunary world, and, you know, Solomon even talked about under the sun and this kind of stuff, that these are poetic passages, and I believe that the Old Testament does not make any statements about cosmology or the history of the universe that are flat out wrong. All right, and so the people that are doing that, I believe, are kind of going in a direction that I think is not helpful. Most of them are perfectly sincere, just trying to help. Feel free to read the stuff. And if you have a question, send it to my website, and I'll do my best to be more specific. All right, yes.
Was having her conversation with the serpent and whatnot. It says, in some versions, it says that Adam was there. Some people say, well, he was there in the garden, but he wasn't there with her.
Right. So what's your question?
So what's the story?
I don't know. If you're asking my opinion... That's my opinion. My opinion is Adam was there, absolutely. That's just my opinion. I don't think it really matters, though. How would it matter in terms of the meaning of that passage? The reason there's debate over that is because the biblical text is not completely clear on that. All right? It's just not. So you can decide for yourself. All right? But let's talk about the theological implications that went on there, because that's all that matters, right? It's the theology of it. And a good question is, why did God put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden? What's that about? Was he trying to tempt them? I mean, we get the tree of life. That's a pretty awesome tree. I'd like to eat from that tree. I believe we will, in the final situation that we're going to be in. But why did God put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil if it was bad for them? I believe the reason he did this is because of free will. God gave us a choice. Can you force somebody to love you? Nope. Why do we exist? Just random molecules bumping into each other, like Dawkins would say? No. The reason we exist is because God wanted to love us. He wanted us to love him, and he wanted us to love one another. That's the biblical explanation for why we exist. Love gives a choice. God gave them a choice. It wasn't like, I'll give you $1 million or I'll punch you in the nose. That's not a choice, right? That's not a choice. And it was desirable. If it hadn't been desirable, it wouldn't have been a choice. The choice was this. Is what God has for you sufficient for you? Because the knowledge they were gaining was knowledge that God did not want them to have. That was not good for them to have. And look at what happened when they got that knowledge. That was destructive. All right, so the theology is what's important. Whether who ate the apple first? Apple. Who ate the fruit is not theologically important. Whether it's factually important is debatable. Whether or not Adam was actually there or not, I don't think changes any of the theology or any of the application. The Bible can be interpreted either way. That's my answer. Okay, yes. There's no scripture that says the earth does not move.
Psalm 104, verse 5.
Okay, let's read that. First of all, when you're reading poetry, David said, against you, you only have I sinned. That's not true. He sinned against Uriah. David said, I was a sinner at birth. That's not true. So when you're reading poetry, I avoid using poetry. For example, in Isaiah it says he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. And I'm not going to use that to prove that the Old Testament says the earth is a sphere. Because it's poetry. And when we read poetry, if we're going to try to get some sort of factual, you know, cosmological information from poetry, that's a really bad idea anyway. Nevertheless, Psalm 104, verse what? Verse 5. Okay, great. Okay, he set the earth and its foundations. It can never be moved. Right, basically what he's saying is God created the earth. He's using very colorful, poetic language. God made it, and that settles it. That's what he's saying. He's saying in a poetic way. Poets say stuff like that all the time. Just read any poet you want. They use all kinds of metaphors, and you take, I don't know, whatever. Lord Byron, do you take him literally? No, of course you don't. So I think what he's saying is God created the earth, and just like the earth does not change, although it changes a little bit, right? I mean, similarly, God does not change. So I think he's talking about God. He's not saying literally the earth doesn't move. Okay? Now, again, when it comes to this holy day, I gave my opinion that the Bible makes no errors of cosmology if understood correctly. I have friends who disagree with me on that. Okay, so just so you know. All right. Here's why. Because I have not found a clear error ever. And every time people say this is an error, I go, no, it's not. Just read it. And I'm prepared to give the Bible the benefit of the doubt, especially, you know, like, as the example with my wife. I mean, unless somebody can show me a clear example where the Bible makes a definite statement. You know, for example, Paul talked about the third heaven, right? So what's that about? Well, first of all, to the Greeks, the first heaven was the sky. The second heaven was the universe beyond the sky. And the third heaven was heaven. All right? So when Paul said, I went to the third heaven, from the Greek perspective, what he's saying is, I went to heaven. So it's not a statement that there's three different levels of heaven. But that's the kind of stuff that people try to use to show that the Bible accommodates false information, when it so obviously, in my opinion, doesn't. And, you know, I'm going to, you know, for example, they say this is a contradiction. You know, for example, in Matthew it says the Gerasenes, and in Mark it says the Gadarenes or whatever. All right, well, it just so happens that Gadara and Gerasa were two different cities. One was a Greek city, the one was the Jewish city. And it turns out it was in the region of the Gadarenes, the Jewish perspective, Matthew. It was also in the region of the Gerasenes, the Greco-Roman. So the bottom line is, I give the benefit of the doubt to the Bible for very good reason, because every time I do, I'm right. And when I try not to, I find myself embarrassed later on, so I gave up doing it. So people who say the Bible accommodates false ideas, and God allowed false ideas to come into the Bible, I'm sorry, I just don't agree with that. And I've never been given reason to change my mind. I've had so many women ask questions in a row, which is a great thing. I'm going to actually take an actual guy. Then I'll come back over here. Yes?
Something I always wonder is in Joshua, when they talk about the sun not
saying. Yeah, right.
Yeah, so has there been any documentation right. outside of the Bible to say that happened?
All right, so the whole Joshua thing. Now, by the way, probably every single question that's been asked during this session is at my website. I've answered, I think, 2,400 questions. They're published there. I don't know. First of all, the whole Lost Day thing, that's conspiracy theory. The people who believe in that Lost Day are the ones who believe that the humans haven't gone to the moon yet. There's the same people. That's conspiracy theorists. They believe that the universe, that the Americans were responsible for 9/11. All right. So there's, all right. So, I mean, I'm going to finish answering the question here, then I'll take another one. So anyway, I think it was so amazing. It was like the day stretched on forever and ever and ever. I think that's what's going on there. I think he's just saying, what a day it was. I think that's what's happening. Okay, I'm going to take this one, and then I think there's a guy back there who's going to be first. But there was somebody over here first, I think, wasn't there? Yes, go ahead. Yep. Of what verse? Okay, Psalm 104? Okay. All right, yeah. Well, first of all, so she's saying, what about the different translations? First of all, we have to understand the genre of the Psalms, which is poetry. It's expressing emotion. And, for example, Leviticus is God talking to us. Psalms is us talking to God. Right? Leviticus is God talking to us. Psalms is us talking to God. So you have to understand that. And then, you know, what you need to do if you really want to delve into it is go into the Hebrew. By the way, you do not have to know Hebrew to use the Hebrew. Neither do you have to know Greek. So what you do is you get either Greek or Hebrew interlinear, depending on which testament, and you find out each individual Greek or Hebrew word. You find out the meaning of those words. And then you can do the interlinear, so you can see, all right, so here's seven or eight different translations, here's the actual words, here's the exact, or as close to exact translation of the words, and you start looking at those things, and you can start to make some pretty good decisions about what it means. By the way, some people ask, which is the best translation of the Bible? The answer is five different translations. That's the best translation. Because here's the Greek word. Here's one English word. Here's another English word. All right? And you need both English words to begin to get a measure of the Greek word. And if five of them use this English word and only one of them use that one, it's probably, you know, it's probably closer to that. I believe that unless you know a massive amount of either Greek or Hebrew, a little bit of knowledge is probably not helpful at all. We have plenty of resources. So that's what I do when people ask me questions like that. By the way, I do not know Greek. I don't. It's kind of embarrassing, Bible teacher not knowing Greek, but I don't. But, I mean, it is not hard. It is really not hard at all. If you have a complete concordance, what you can do is, let's say there's a particular word in English, you can look up that word in English in your complete concordance. It'll tell you which Greek or Hebrew word is being used. It'll also tell you every other verse that uses that particular Greek or Hebrew word. But also, you can then go back to all the examples of that English word and find out all the Greek or Hebrew words translated that way. We have so many tools available to us that we can make a really solid decision about the meaning of Psalm 104, verse 5. But remember, it's poetry anyway. So please read it as poetry. I've had a lot of people raise hands, and so I'm going to forget. So, yeah, but I think I said your first. Oh, just do a search. For example, let's see. What was the last question? About, do a search. When I tried, by the way, I don't know where the questions are. I find them by doing a search. It's easy. Right. So you want to find out about the Matthew 8 and Mark 5. Just type in Gadarenes. Or type in demoniac. Or type in pigs, whatever. It's totally easy to find any question that you're interested in. All right, yes, and then over here. Her and then him. Yeah. All right, yeah, that's a great question. So were Adam and Eve the first humans? I hate to say it, but I don't know. There were apparently things like Australopithecus running around and you know, Lucy and all that sort of stuff. So there's two possibilities, and I don't know. One of them is easier to accept for a biblical Christian. The other one's a little bit harder to accept. So one possibility is that all humans, you know, Homo sapiens, descend from the original Adam and Eve. And the very, very, very narrow range of genetics within the human population is consistent with that idea. Or you could say that there were evolved intelligent creatures and God put his image into two of them, and all of us who are in God's image descend from those two. The second theory is a little bit harder for Christians to accept, honestly, but you have to decide. All right, so one thing I know for sure is we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and I'm not just talking about our bodies. You know, the fact that we can experience God, that we can know God, we have a soul. Everything that makes us human could not have evolved. So therefore, I believe in Adam and Eve. Totally. All right? And the idea that our consciousness evolved, that doesn't make sense. Consciousness does not evolve. All right? Our morality did not evolve from apes trying to be nice to each other. I'm sorry, I don't believe that. But whether there were other beings which were almost the same as Adam and Eve, and God put his spirit into two of them, or whether all of us ever that were descended from them, I simply don't know. I don't know when Adam and Eve lived. All right, the Bible isn't very helpful there. All right, there's one over here. I'm going to take maybe only two more questions because we did promise to finish by 7:30. Yes. Yeah.
That's kind of like you're not in line with that. So is there any
What do you mean I'm not in line with it?
I mean, as far as like there's actual 7 days.
All right, yeah.
Monday,
right, that it did not happen over a simple 6 day, 7 times 24, whatever that is. Yeah.
So, is there any theories out there how long that creation period was? Was that like evolutionary period?
All right. Who's that guy, Dan, who did the sort of exponential decay? Who's that?
Gerald Schroeder.
Gerald Schroeder wrote a fascinating book, which is very interesting, which he proposes using a mathematical formula to explain those days. And the fact is, it works incredibly well. It's just amazing. I don't know about that. Gerald Schroeder. Remember I told you earlier that Dan knows more apologetics than I do? Proven again. It's always true. If you have questions about apologetics, the guy's just sitting here in your region, so you don't have to have me come down for that. So the answer is yes, there are people who have done that. For us as Christians, it flat out doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I couldn't care less whether the earth is old or not. It has no effect on me. None. The only thing is, the idea that the earth is young and that science agrees with that, I have a problem with that because it doesn't, and that could be a serious stumbling block. So if you want to teach the earth being young, okay, fine, but teach that as a theological concept based on the idea that God could do whatever he wants. He could make children of Abraham from these stones. I believe it. I totally believe it. So again, the framework model, which is probably there's more sort of intellectual, smart, but true, honest, really total believer types, probably more would go with the framework model than the day-age model. So I'm kind of a dinosaur there. I'm sticking with it, though. I'm 64. I'm not going to change. This is specifically referencing evolution. One theory basically says evolution didn't happen, other than very, very, very tiny amounts, you know, microevolution. And that's the young earth idea. Another idea is the idea of intelligent design, which I didn't do a decent job of even explaining. But the intelligent design camp, which is a large camp, basically says that there are kinds of complexity in living things which literally could not have evolved by any conceivable mechanism. And therefore, they're highly skeptical of the idea of common descent. Okay? And the difference between myself and that group is almost none, honestly. Really. Except I'm just not so skeptical as they are. All right? And then there's the idea that what I call theistic evolution, which is the idea that the theory of evolution is not problematic. It's just that God seems to have in his nature, you know, directed or intervened at various times for various reasons, so that without God, it would not happen that way. And then there's the deistic model, which says basically God wound it up and let it go. Okay, those are the four I described. Like I said, those are four Christian views of evolution. So you could have all four kinds in your church. Who cares? You got Democrats and Republicans in your church, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Does it matter? Well, some people think it does, but it doesn't. You can go to heaven either way. Yes, you can. I'm quoting a political... Yes, we can. But anyway, sorry. Couldn't help it. All right, we ran out of time. All right, but honestly, absolutely last one. Okay.
When Abel killed Cain,
yeah.
God put a mark and say nobody can kill you. So that why did he say that? It was no more people alive.
Okay. So anyway, God says the Bible says he put a mark on Cain. What that mark was, we don't know. But basically, the mark was, I'm protecting that guy, so don't you take him on. Which is amazing. God's grace towards Cain is amazing. Look what Cain did, and look how God treated Cain. God loved Cain, and he protected him. But I don't understand your question. What?
The question is, he put the mark to say nobody can kill him.
Right.
And then supposedly was no more people.
What do you mean there are no more people? There was Seth. All right, how about this? How long did Adam and Eve live? I don't know, whatever, 500 years. So how many years was Eve able to conceive? I don't know, let's say 100 years. Do you think she and Adam kept having sex? Yeah, sure, let's say they did, okay? So let's say she had 50 children. Now she's 500 years old. Seth is now 450 years old. He's got great, 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 great grandchildren, right? And, you know, how long was he and his wife able to have children? I don't know. So within 500 years, you know, who knows how many people there could have been. So Cain's walking around, who am I going to marry? I don't know, my cousin, my third cousin, my sister, whatever. But the idea that there was a population, a significant population. I mean, if we were having kids, heaven forbid, ladies, right? Heaven forbid having children for 100 years. That's who Cain married. All right, is this, you know, within a generation or so, there'd be many, many people. All right, sorry about that. I'm going to call it quits because we used up our time. And I'm hungry.
In regards to just your opinion, what do you think about like church doctrine coming from, you know, the epistles, which are often written in like social cultural context?
Oh, you have to every example should be taken one at a time. So you have to give me a specific example.
Okay, so like when was Christianity.org, the next day or two.